the idea of adding the social aspect to learning. In traditional learning, it's more about the content and the presentation of the content. When we talk about learning 2.0 or e-learning 2.0, we're talking about the use of social networking and interactive services online in order to allow people to connect with each other in order to extend their learning capacity.
So which are the main advantages of this type of learning?
Well, one of the big problems with traditional e-learning is it's very isolated. You're on your own. You don't have anyone to compare notes with. And learning is, for most of us, very much a social thing. It's something that we typically do in groups or we typically do with other people so that we can test our ideas and compare our progress so that we know if we're doing good or bad. And so being able to interact online with other people who are learning the same sort of things that we're doing allows us to have that. It allows us to find out how we're doing. It allows us to test our ideas and basically to work with other people to fill out our understanding of whatever we're learning.
And from your experience, what do you think that are the disadvantages? For example, lack of social learning. I mean, you don't socialize with other people like if you are in a class.
Well, probably the biggest issue with learning 2.0, I think, is that it presumes that people know how to socialize online. Being able to communicate and interact with people online is a bit different from doing it in the class. Doing it in the classroom, we're talking with people and socializing the way we did since, you know, pretty much the day we were born. It's the same way we socialize with people on a day-to-day basis. Online, it requires a different set of skills. You have to learn how to use social networking tools and software. You kind of have to learn some of what the conventions are. You know, everything from the three-letter acronyms like laugh out loud to just what is appropriate behavior online and what is not appropriate behavior. And then there's, you know, the whole area of what they call digital literacy. And this is being able to use online technologies in such a way as to be able to learn from them, to engage with them, and to actually advance learning.
Mm-hmm. So talking about the skills, which are the main skills that are the students develop with this teaching method?
Well, if you ask different people, you'll get different answers to that. You know, a lot of people will talk about, you know, things like internet ethics. They'll talk about search skills and data processing skills and things like that. From my perspective, I think of it a bit more broadly. I sometimes write about what I call critical literacies. Mm-hmm. And these are the underlying skills that we find in both an online environment and an offline environment. And these are the sorts of things that would be required no matter what kind of job we're doing, what kind of media we're using. Things like, for example, being able to recognize patterns, regularities, rules, principles, and what otherwise might be chaotic data. That's one type of thing. Another type of thing is understanding the context of use of technology or words or expressions or data, because, you know, where you are, where the other person is, changes what they mean, what they say, what they're trying to do. So that's another one. Inference, being able to draw inferences from the data that you have, both deductively and inductively, or being able to look at something that happens and draw an explanation of that. These are important skills to have as well.
Mm-hmm. And which is the profile of students that are attending nowadays this kind of learning? There is a profile? There is a specific or not?
I'd be careful to try to draw out a profile. There mm-hmm. have been studies, for example, of people who take massive open online courses. And these people tend to be more from Western Europe or North America. They tend to be older, they tend to be male, and they tend to be more educated. That's the same sort of profile we saw on the internet generally in 1994. Mm-hmm. And we know that that profile changed a great deal over the years.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of online learning generally, the profile will be similar to the profile of students, because most students today are taking some form of online learning. So that will be a younger group, still relatively affluent, still relatively Western, because they have, you know, access to technologies. So these are probably the current profiles, but again, I would caution against reading too much into them. I think that this is a temporary state.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you think that society globally is ready to adapt, to be adapted to this kind of learning, or we have a lot of work to do?
Well, I think both answers are true. Mm-hmm. You know, the answer to both questions is yes.
Okay.
We're ready to adapt because it's the only way that we're going to be able to provide learning on a global scale. You know, the expense of building an educational infrastructure similar to what we see in the United States or Britain for every country in the world is actually more money than there is in the world. You know, when we consider the buildings, the teachers, the resources, this is a very large expenditure that we would be attempting to undertake, and it's not going to be possible to do it by traditional means. So, you know, we need to invest in e-learning, we need to invest in alternative learning technologies in order to achieve any sort of widespread educational outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is the world ready for that? Well, I mean, obviously, there are large parts of the world that have trouble with electricity and water, and so adding the need for internet is to create an additional challenge for them, and that's a concern. As well, they're, in many cases, not pedagogically ready in the sense that in many parts of the world, including many parts of the Western world, our understanding of pedagogy is presentation and memorization, right? And, you know, this isn't really the way e-learning works best. Yeah. It's not the way learning works best.
Yeah.
But when you're in that mode, you just magnify all the difficulties that you face when you do it online.
Mm-hmm. Because what about the teachers? Are the teachers have the education to teach this way? They are ready to attend this kind of courses or this kind of teaching or not?
Every survey I've seen many surveys, every survey I've seen lists teacher preparation as one of the major hurdles to be overcome. It's really hard because it's such a moving target. You could train all of your teachers today in current technology, and 2 years from now, all the technology has changed. And so you find yourself in 2 years right back where you started with the need to train teachers again. And obviously, this is unsustainable. We need to develop better programs and methods to assist teachers to train themselves. And that's where the real challenge is, I think.
Mm-hmm. Because which is the role of teachers in the online learning?
Well, there are many roles, and these roles are changing.
Yeah.
What we're going to find over time is that the job that we today call the job of being a teacher has split apart into different jobs that are filled by different people. For example, there's the role of presenting content to students. Now, that's normally done by a teacher today. In the future, it will be done by presenters who specialize in presenting content online.
Yeah.
They'll be recorded, probably. They'll do it digitally. Others, you know, another aspect of teaching it is coaching. And this is, you know, the part of the teaching profession which is a supporting task, a mentoring task, a facilitating task, and this will become a specialization as well. A third part is assessment and evaluation, and the need for these things doesn't go away, but I'm quite sure that in the future we will approach the whole question of assessment and evaluation differently, and it will be done by different people. It may be even be done by automated mechanisms with human oversight. So all of these roles are different roles that the teacher takes. And I was just reading a column from Dave Cormier today. He said the major role of the teacher is to challenge, provoke, and stimulate students in an effort to motivate them to be interested in and to engage in the learning that they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. And what about, I don't know how you pronounce this, Dave, but what about MOOC, MOOC?
MOOC.
Okay. For people that doesn't hear, have never hear about it, what is it about? Briefly.
Okay. MOOC stands for Massive Open Online Course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what it is a course that is offered online. We've offered a number of them. And what makes it different from other courses is that it's designed in such a way that hundreds, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people can take the course all at once. And this is done by making the course open. So you don't have to sign up for it. You don't have to pay tuition fees. Everything you need to take the course is available on the open internet. So if you want to take the course, you simply access the course.
Mm-hmm.
And that may mean accessing course materials. It may mean doing some automated assessment or assignments or things like that. It may mean participating in discussions with people online or in your own community. There are different ways that these are set up.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea here is that they are created out of open educational resources that anybody can access, share, and use to support their own learning.
Mm-hmm. I have read that there is a lot of high number of students that leave MOOC before ending it. Which is the reason? We don't have enough, we don't know how to learn by ourselves, or we don't have enough motivation to do it, or?
Well, there's probably as many different reasons for ending a MOOC as there are people. The suggestions that you've made are all very likely, but you know, I would point out too that there is not a large investment that a person makes in signing up for a MOOC to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was one of the 150,000 people, for example, to sign up to the Stanford KI MOOC. That was my first and only interaction with that course.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did not pay tuition. I did not quit my job. I did not travel to Southern California in order to take this course. So my investment in the course was much lower. That's a good thing because it turns out that if a person doesn't have the time, the interest, the inclination to take a course, they can leave it very easily. So it's not a bad thing that a lot of people drop out of MOOCs. So that's one thing. Another thing is we have to keep in mind it is not the objective of every person in the course to finish the course. It wasn't mine when I signed up for the Stanford AI MOOC, but a lot of people are just curious. They just want to browse the course. They want to look at a few of the resources. An online course, when offered as a MOOC, is more like a newspaper than it's like a traditional course, which is structured like a book. Right? In the case of a book, you start at the beginning, you go through it, and you finish at the end. Right? The book fails if you don't finish it. But a newspaper, you don't start at the beginning and read everything and finish. Right? You pick and choose the things that are most important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the, you know, what we call an affordance of an open course is you can pick and choose those aspects of the course that are interesting, relevant, and useful to you. And most of the time, you don't need the whole course.
Yeah.
And since that's true, most of the time, people will, as they say, drop out. But, you know, they never intended to finish the
That's right. And should the people that attend MOOCs have specific skills or not?
So, we mentioned earlier some of the women with those skills that people need, you know, and especially the critical literacies. And I think that this is going to be true. People are going to need to be able to use digital technology to communicate, to find information, and you know, and they need to have these literacies, the pattern recognition, the ability to make inferences, things like that. They need to be able to express those in a digital environment. We actually did try teaching a course called Critical Literacies to see if we could use an online learning environment in order to teach people the skills they need to succeed in an online learning environment, kind of like bootstrapping. And we had mixed results with that, and I think I need to try it again to see if that's possible.
Okay, and the final question. What do you think about the current education system? Do you think that governments should change the education as we understand now? I mean, the schools, for example, the basic education?
Well, that's a hard question because you know, there are more than 200 governments in the world and they each manage education differently. So,
I mean, globally.
You know, I mean, different societies have different objectives and different ideals when it comes to education. In Finland, for example, they're community-oriented, they're cooperative-oriented, and they're commercially-oriented, and this is something that works really well for Finland. But it wouldn't work really well for, say, the United States, because the United States is based on a system that emphasizes competition much more than Finland. And you can't just import, you know, cooperation to the United States, and you can't just import competition to Finland and expect it to work. So I think that each nation, indeed, in Canada, education is a provincial responsibility, so each province needs to develop its own educational policy according to the needs of the individual province. If I had to say there was a foundation anywhere, I'd say that the foundation has to be in the needs and the interests of the individual student or the individual learner. I view education as an exercise in empowerment, in giving them the capacity and the ability to make their own choices and make their own way through life. And I think that's an objective that is at least shared by most jurisdictions, if unequally applied by most jurisdictions.
Okay, perfect. So I'm going to ask you a few questions about your childhood that you can try choose if you want to answer or not. I don't care. It's just that I'm going to write down like a biography of you. So which was your favorite book when you were a child?
Oh, my favorite book when I was a child.
Or one of your favorites.
Yeah. Well, I really like, there was a series of books called The White Mountains. Who wrote those? I think John Howard, I think, was the person who wrote those.
I can search it online. Is it good?
Yeah, I'm just looking.
Okay.
I like that. So that was a series. It's just a series of science fiction books. They're all written by John Christopher, beginning in 1967. And that introduced me to science fiction. My second science fiction book was A Fall of Moon Dust by Arthur C. Clarke. Following that, I read probably, well, certainly thousands of science fiction books, maybe more. You know, if it was written, I read it. So I just deeply, deeply immersed in science fiction. Now, what this did for me is it prepared me for a life in both science and philosophy.
Yeah.
And it was very influential on me. And it also suited my natural aptitude, right? Science and philosophy, that's kind of where I belong anyways. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. And which was your favorite subject, science?
Believe it or not, geography.
Oh.
I love geography. that was easily, by far and away, my favorite subject.
And the one you didn't like? Okay, you didn't even think about it.
Yeah, well, and thinking about it, I still also have French.
Okay, something about your school that you still remember, some memories, specific memories, something specific that you did or something, some project or...
That's a hard question because I did... I mean, I had an odd sort of schooling, right? I grew up for the first, until grade five in a big city environment in Montreal. And then we moved to a small town south of Ottawa called Metcalfe, Ontario. So I went from a big city school to a small rural school. It was a very traumatic transition for me. So I spent most of my years in school kind of an outsider, and I think that really influenced me a lot. But some of the things that I did public speaking in school. I remember very clearly winning the school public speaking competition when I was in grade five. And so this is my first year in the new school. And I won the competition. I beat the older students who were in grade eight. And our grade five class carried me out of the gymnasium on their shoulders. That's how dramatic it was. So I made a speech about Sir Frederick Banting, who was a Canadian scientist who discovered insulin, with Banting and Best. So that was pretty memorable. I did it again in grade.
That's a good one.
And several more public speaking contests after that.
Okay. Well, so that's it. I have enough information to do it. So if you want, I can send you the interview before we publish so you can check it. And also would be perfect if you can send me both pictures of you, one a landscape picture of you as an adult and another one of you as a child, so we can publish it.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, so thank you so much for attending the interview. It has been really interesting.
You're very welcome.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.